Hello and welcome back to the Lily Pod, the podcast that seeks to explore the layers and complexities of identity, kinship, and relations as it connects to sexuality, gender, and dynamics of power. Today's episode is a little different, much more structured in a way I'm a little unfamiliar with on this platform, but it's dedicated to interrogating some of the principal elements of rape culture that are reproduced within social structures, attitudes, and norms. This interrogation in this format is meant to serve as a site of understanding the ways in which the culture of sexual violence is naturalized and made invisible within social structures, institutions, and spaces of teaching and learning. Understanding the elements of rape culture as framed by scholars that we'll explore in a little bit, whose research specializes in sexual violence prevention, will help us to better understand the ways in which this culture is allowed to function and how this creates environments of non-consent, disguising these spaces as natural and prohibiting individual agency and any opportunity for empowerment. Consent, as we seem to understand it culturally, is quite an ambiguous term with a lot of cracks and crevices in its foundation as a supposedly black and white yes or no thing of language and practicality. And the way that we understand consent as this very black and white thing, it's either there or it's not there, often doesn't take into consideration the non-physical elements present within interactions. That is, there's very little attention paid to pre-existing power dynamics between individuals within spaces and within particular circumstances which shape a person's capacity to exercise a particular type of choice. On these shaky grounds of misunderstanding consent and often misplacing it, that is, not fully accounting for it within spaces that really require clear definitions and practical implementations of this notion, it's no wonder there is so much ambiguity surrounding our discussions of consent and what it really means. So, to start our work in understanding the foundation of rape culture as facilitative to non-consensual environments, I want to introduce a 2021 study conducted by Johnson & Johnson, and the study centers an empirical exploration into the measurement of rape culture. And essentially what this means is their study was concerned with observation and experience rather than just theorizing this culture. So the study specifically focuses on the pre-existing model of rape culture constructed in the 1980s that was then expanded in the 1990s in the efforts to measure rape myth acceptance. And Johnson & Johnson explore these five components of this model of quantifying rape culture, identifying the factors that uphold this culture's presence in our world today. They introduce the cultural theory of rape, or the theory of rape culture, as originating in the 1970s during the rise of second wave feminism, importantly pointing to the fact that since this initial theorizing, there has been very little effort made to empirically verify this idea of rape culture. And the original most comprehensive model of rape culture proposed in 1980 by Martha Burt presents traditional gender roles, adversarial sexual beliefs, and acceptance of interpersonal violence as the central components to creating a culture of sexual violence. In this theorizing, Burt explains that these components are then made socially normal through gendered processes of socialization. And these processes include the teaching of boys to be sexually dominant, aggression being encouraged and made to be natural and associated with masculinity, and the parallel teaching of girls to be sexually passive. And this is cited by Johnson & Johnson from their 2021 piece. They also make the important point that while culturally we may denounce the actual act of rape, we are simultaneously normalizing non-consensual sexual behaviors, values, and attitudes. And what this does is it creates a culture where rape and other forms of non-consensual touch are normal. The desensitization of violence, as bolstered by the cultural acceptance of these acts of violence and misogyny, particularly against women and queer people, are also both key contributors to the naturalization of rape culture, which Johnson & Johnson highlight in their study. They try to articulate how these elements of our culture work to, quote, excuse the perpetration of rape and sexual assault, unquote, from 2021 on page 3 of their article. Johnson & Johnson also outlined the theoretical components of rape culture as proposed by Burt from 1980, starting with traditional gender roles. They are defined as, quote, roles, responsibilities, and interests of men and women based on cultural norms and expectations, unquote, Burt 1980. Examples of these roles that exist in our culture include the idea that men are dominant, women are submissive, men are aggressive, women are docile, men are hypersexual, women are these pure Madonna-type beings. Connected to this idea, we can explore Diane Hurtman's 1984 conversation of the ways that American culture creates rapists when it encourages the socialization of men to, quote, subscribe to values of control and dominance, callousness and competitiveness, and anger and aggression, and when it discourages the expression by men of vulnerability, sharing, and cooperation, unquote, as cited in Johnson 2021, page 4. Along with these ideas of traditional gender roles and binary thinking comes the inevitable cultural devaluation of women. Johnson & Johnson outlined the social and structural functioning of sexism and this devaluation of women, naming two conceptualizations of sexism, both hostile and benevolent. Hostile sexism are more overt expressions of hatred for women, the more obvious ones, and benevolent being the sort of like nice guy, chivalrous attitudes toward women, framing women as innately weak and in need of rescuing or protection from men. The important thing here is that no matter what these forms of sexism look like, they both function insidiously and quite overtly to create a culture of victim blaming, which views women as naturally inferior to men, solidifying their subordinate position beneath men as inevitable and natural. And we'll so often hear this argument being made that that's just the way things are, that's just the natural order of things, in order for people to reinforce these ideas of gender and continue to shove people into these boxes of where they're supposedly supposed to belong. This leads us to the third component of rape culture, which revolves around adversarial sexual beliefs, essentially the thought that all of human sexuality is determined by gendered expectations, that men are only interested in sex, women are manipulative and cunning and not to be trusted. This is where that same victim-blaming rhetoric steps in, bolstered by the idea that women should know to expect the sexual desire of men because that's just how men are. And if a woman didn't want to have sex, then she shouldn't have agreed to be with this man at all. This leaves no room for consent to be understood contextually and complicatedly, as it reproduces the idea that consent is something entirely individually shaped without consideration to power dynamics and larger scales of oppression that might shape relations, interactions, and environments. It also doesn't take into account the fogginess that may exist in different contexts, whether sexual or not, that entirely shapes the possibility for people, namely women and queer people, to exercise individual choice. Also connected to this idea of adversarial sexual beliefs is a general hostility towards women, which is rooted in the idea that all women are inherently deceptive, manipulative, and out to destroy the male gender. Such cultural beliefs, Johnson & Johnson argue, work to justify and legitimize violence against women, making it the fourth component of rape culture. To further illustrate this point, there's research shown by Marshall and Molden from 2001, as well as Scott and Teatrol from 1987, highlighting that statistics of male sexual offenders signaled significantly greater negative views toward women in comparison with non-sexual offenders and non-offending male subjects, which just goes to demonstrate the clear correlation between misogynistic hostility and the exercise of sexually targeted violence against women. To top all of these points off is the common cultural justification of violence, not only in sexual contexts, but within all spheres of human life. And some examples of this justified violence, which Johnson & Johnson provide, include the carceral system, the corporal punishment of children, and war violence, just to name a few. Each of these justifications for the presence of violence in our culture continue to bolster the acceptance and continual reproduction of sexually specific violence, including rape, sexual assault, and other forms of non-consensual touch. This is the final component to rape culture that Johnson & Johnson explore as they work to try to explain how this naturalization and expectation of this somehow inevitable masculine violence is integral to this culture of rape that's been created, where physical aggression is seen as a natural response to our surrounding environment, certainly for men who are taught to feel entitled to enacting such aggression in ways that support their masculinity. There's a chapter in Diane Crocker's 2020 book, Violence Interrupted, on Countering Rape Culture with Resistance Education, written by Rodke et al., that adds to this discussion greatly, especially in their underlining of how social processes enable sexual violence as normal, natural, and even acceptable within our society. Rodkay speaks to the importance of confronting not only the symptoms of this culture of violence, but actually getting to the root of where these attitudes are reproduced in order to challenge this issue. On page 350 of Crocker's Violence Interrupted, Rodkay also points to the gendered culture of victim blaming as a key component to rape culture, as we've mentioned before. They underline this point in speaking about the creation of sexual violence prevention programs, highlighting how crucial it is for these programs to adopt a person-centered approach that don't contribute to the culture of victim blaming, which is a central component to the normalized culture of sexual violence. The essential takeaway from Rodkay's chapter is that prevention programs focused on sexual violence need to target rape culture as the issue, rather than taking a victim-blaming approach to addressing this violence. And in order to target this culture, we need to understand the ways that it operates, how it makes itself appear invisible and natural, and in what ways it is being continually reproduced within social spaces. Adding on to this, Henry and Powell, some other theorists who collaborated on the works of Preventing Sexual Violence, Interdisciplinary Approaches to Overcoming a Rape Culture from 2014, similarly underlined the importance of addressing cultural attitudes, values, norms, and beliefs about sexuality, gender, and violence in efforts to respond to both micro and macro levels of cultural violence. The complicated thing about addressing institutional harm is that it's so hard to pin down. It's so hard to grapple with when we feel so small, so powerless in contrast with those making the decisions that shape our social realities. But Henry and Powell remind us the importance of holding both individualized and collectivized approaches to confronting this violence, as they each play an important role in reacting to reinforcements of violence. Henry M. Powell's book that explores these approaches to overcoming a culture of rape is focused on using analytical frameworks and strategies across disciplines in order to provide an empirical investigation of primary prevention, that is, prevention of violence that targets issues before they are likely to occur, which is a form of prevention that is severely lacking in literature on sexual violence. Henry and Powell continue to speak to the ways in which the sexual violence prevention programs are lacking on page 5 of their chapter, Framing Sexual Violence Prevention, in their discussion of this cultural rhetoric surrounding the supposed inevitability of rape so often expressed in public campaigns that focus on what people, namely women, can do to prevent themselves from being attacked, rather than actually recognizing the social and cultural variables that influence and ultimately determine cases of sexual violence. Essentially, the point they're trying to get us to hear is this: challenging the fundamental roots of rape culture is the key to sexual violence prevention. No amount of protection or preemptive education telling people how to stop themselves from being assaulted will actually stop this violence from happening. We have to get to the root of it and uproot it. In thinking about ways that this culture manifests and how we need to understand it in order to challenge it, Henry and Powell help us in figuring out the specific ways that rape culture manifests in our lives, specifically pointing to everyday expressions of this culture in mainstream media, advertising, and social media. Henry and Powell go on to say, this is quoted from their 2014 piece on page 6, that rape is made, quote, a dominant cultural script, unquote, setting up models of femininity and masculinity that seem to always frame women as inherently rapeable. They go on to cite Martirosyan from 2002, who argues that, quote, making women's behavior and identity the site of rape prevention only mirrors the dominant culture's proclivity to see rape as women's problem, both in the sense of a problem women should solve and one that they caused, unquote. And that was cited by Henry and Powell from 2014 on page 6. They also pay particular attention to the genderedness of this issue, explaining that approaches to rape and rape culture prevention involve understandings of shared community societal responsibilities, that is, not seeing women and queer people as only victims and men as perpetrators, but rather within a broader understanding of gender relations and overarching social systems that shape these subjects within particular narratives of dominance and submission, passiveness and aggression, as determined by patriarchy, capitalism, and other forms of exploitation. Ultimately, Henry and Powell are arguing that we must understand all social subjects, including ourselves, no matter our gendered positionality, as bystanders and supporters of rape culture. It is in acknowledging our role in this system that we may learn to understand the intricacies of how it operates, how we internalize it, and thus try to reflect on how we might challenge it. Mm-hmm. Now that we've spent some time unpacking what this culture is, how it operates, and how to understand it in relation to our own social position, we can start to think about what this means for how we define consent, if we even define it at all, particularly in public spaces. With this ever-present force of rape culture surrounding us in both our public and our private lives, understanding and defining consent can be a really complicated and ambiguous thing. It's not always clear, if ever, and it definitely isn't treated as something of crucial nuance or any importance, really, in spaces where we engage in physical contact. There are so many social spaces in this world where a touch is a central factor to their very existence, but how much is it actually being talked about? Is it considered part of a bigger conversation around what it means to exist in particular spaces when we occupy certain bodies, when we carry with us certain dynamics of power, depending on the color of our skin, the shape of our physical form, the way we present ourselves, gender ourselves, perform our humanity, the entitlement we might feel over particular others, and how this all translates to the way we relate to others within space? This is not a part of our culture. This is not a part of how we teach and we learn within spaces. And so I want to bring in the work of Chelsea Morgan, a sexuality and justice educator and intimacy director and coordinator, who explores these very ideas of consent, specifically in touch-oriented spaces, in their 2022 article, Visions for Justice and Critiquing Consent on Taking Performativity Out of Performance. Morgan prompts us with questions about what consent means within a culture of rape, how it is communicated, how might it be ensured, and what happens when conceptions of consent fail us. Morgan cites Ariane Cruz, a kink scholar and women's gender and sexuality studies educator, who writes that, quote, consent is not a universal principle. It does not have the same valence for everyone. This is from her 2016 book, Color of Kink, Black Women, BDSM, and Pornography, from pages 45 to 46. Morgan's reference to Cruz is used to illustrate the ways that consent lives ambivalently within power dynamics and exchanges, often in ways that continue to create hierarchy within the realm of sexuality and of gender. Morgan also encourages us to consider the complexities of defining consent as it relates to experiences of trauma, power dynamics, and systematically internalized oppression, specifically how these forces work to create a culture of very binaristic black and white thinking about consent in our world, seeing it as something without ambiguity, only as a yes or no exchange, leaving little to no room for nuance in how we try to tackle understanding consent. What Morgan is doing here is trying to get us to understand that any vision for consent, or any concept for that matter, that treats it as an absolute truth is one to be challenged. Morgan is inviting us to rethink our learned frameworks for understanding consent by intentionally shifting our language toward justice. And Morgan defines justice as, quote, a vision for the future, unquote, on page 83. A central part of this vision for the future is understanding consent as a practice, something malleable, something we exercise, we improve, a skill that we need to work on, that we need to apply and maintain in our everyday practice. And integral to this practice is also an understanding of the histories, livelihoods, and safeties as this all relates to marginalized and dehumanized communities and people, specifically including women, queer people, racialized people, and disabled people. To quote Morgan from their 2022 piece on page 84, quote, we need to understand the impact that our identities and the structures we work under can have on decisions to consent, and we cannot simply lean on the global majority members of our communities to take on that risk. The community as a whole needs to expand their visions for justice, and yes, to do so, we need to look beyond consent, unquote. What we're particularly looking for beyond this consent is power, and this is what Morgan is trying to bring us back to. This also returns us to our discussion of rape culture, looking deep into its insidious operations and manifestations, and analyzing our personal relationship to this kind of power. These ideas that Morgan leaves us with let us reflect on how we might understand consent as a vision for the future, moving away from using it as a buzzword, as something to throw in a conversation without much second thought about it, and instead using it as an intentional practice. It's messy, it's complicated, it's ambiguous, But the way that we understand consent in a culture of rape that naturalizes sexual violence and essentially coerces us to be complicit in this culture, we need to understand consent with consideration to the future and what could come if only we rethink our framework for understanding this notion within a culture of sexual violence. We need to think about these dynamics of power, how they operate, and our specific position within these, how we might be complicit, and how we might use our own small tools of power to create change. And I encourage us all to keep reflecting on these ideas and how they manifest in our lives, what they mean to us, and how we might reorient ourselves and our relationship to understanding consent within this culture that naturalizes such targeted forms of violence.
If you or anyone you know are in need of crisis support in relation to sexual violence, you can visit Ending Violence Association of Canada. This website will point you to different directories depending on your province and will also direct you to national crisis and support lines that are more specific to particular people and populations, including queer and trans youth, Indigenous women, and victims of domestic violence. If you are specifically based in Montreal, you can visit the Women's Center of Montreal website at centredesfemmesdemontreal.org for various forms of psychosocial support.